Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, the 2nd of January 2018, and you're tuned to DW's Africa Link. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kemet.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. Welcome to the program. And it's coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. And we're also live on Facebook, DW Africa.
On the program today, Ugandan president signs into law a bill removing presidential age limit that will allow him to run for another term.
We will challenge this law in the courts of judicature.
I guess that's the opposition commenting about the law signed, you know, by the president himself.
Yes, indeed. And a quick one here coming from Maurice Mukebalai says, the country is now finished. This is the same man who said, the trouble with African leaders, once in office, they want to die on the chair.
Many of these comments will come later on the program. We shall also be hearing why the Catholic Church in the Democratic Republic of Congo is encouraging demonstrations against the government of President Joseph Kabila.
The church was key to the signing of the accord at the end of 2016. It's pretty much the only institution in the DRC with the moral authority to act as a sort of referee.
These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you.
But first, let's listen to what's been happening around the world.
My name is Jen Nyinge with DW News. We start off in Uganda, where President Yoweri Museveni has signed into law the controversial age limit bill, paving the way for him to extend his 31-year rule. The 73-year-old president had previously been barred from seeking re-election in 2021 by the constitutional age gap of 75 years. Civil society organizations led by Crispin Kaheru have described the change of law as part of a well-orchestrated plan to have President Museveni rule for life.
We are going to challenge this law in both courts of law and in courts of public opinion. In the end, it is the majority of Ugandans who will have the last say on how they wish to be governed.
Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has accused enemies of his country of stirring unrest as the death toll from anti-government demonstrations across the country that began last week rose to over 20 people. Khamenei did not name any specific countries, but said he would explain more in the near future.
The enemy is waiting for a crack to emerge in which it can infiltrate. Look at the recent incidents. Enemies of Iran have used various means, including money, weapons, politics, and intelligence apparatus, to create troubles for the Islamic State.
Moving on, the US, Britain, and Norway have called on parties in the South Sudan conflict to respect a ceasefire signed last month after reported violations. The ceasefire is the latest attempt to end a four-year civil war that has killed tens of thousands. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. South Korea has proposed high-level talks with North Korea next week. The proposal came one day after Pyongyang suggested talks, despite sticking to its nuclear ambitions. Although the talks will mainly focus on North Korea's participation at the Olympics, other issues are likely to arise, according to South Korean Unification Minister Chung Myung-yen.
We look forward to candidly discussing mutual interests from both sides, face to face, to improve relationships along with the North Koreans' participation in the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics.
Now to Israel, where the parliament has passed a law that would make it harder for the government to cede parts of Jerusalem to Palestinians under any future peace deal. The law makes it mandatory to obtain the approval of 80 of the 120 assembly members to change the status of Jerusalem. And finally, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has released a video message claiming a series of attacks in northwest Nigeria during the festive season. This is his first video message in months amid a surge in violence, casting doubt on the Nigerian government's claim that the jihadist group is defeated. For more news and information, visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. My name is Jane Nyinge.
Welcome to the program once again, wherever you're listening to us from. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. And we start off in Uganda, where the president, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, has signed into law a bill removing presidential age limits. This implies that the 73-year-old is eligible for presidency 2021. The controversial constitutional amendment removes the age limit of 75 years imposed on presidential candidates and was pushed through by the ruling party members of parliament last month.
And on the other hand, their amendment reimposes a two-term limit on the presidency scrubbed by the ruling party MPs in 2005. Veteran opposition leader Kizza Besigye described the law change as part of a well-orchestrated plan to have Museveni rule for life. From Kampala, Alex Gita has been finding out more.
The newly signed law does not only remove presidential age limit, it also allows any Ugandan aged 18 and above to stand for presidency and extends the term of members of parliament from 5 years to 7 years. That means that the current MPs will serve till 2023 and not 2021. Opposition members of parliament have threatened to challenge the new law in court. Winifred Niwagaba is one of them.
Those who were actually appealing to him to use his conscience amused me. In respect of clinging onto power, Museveni has no sense of shame and no conscience. We will challenge this law in the courts of judicature, and it will be up to the members of the bench to either allow the Museveni to be used and abused as parliamentarians way, or they stand their ground and administer justice according to the wishes of the people.
The bill was largely unpopular and many Ugandans have voiced their disappointment. Perry Aritua, who is the executive director for Women's Democracy Network, says African leaders are using their country's laws to legitimize their long stay in power.
These days, African leaders have changed their tactic. It's no longer about coups, but they legitimize their stay by using the law.
Some civil society organizations that have also been campaigning against the bill had their bank accounts frozen to date, as the police claimed that they were being funded to destabilize Uganda. Crispin Kaheru is the coordinator of the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy.
In as much as the president has assented to the age limit bill, this law is going to remain largely inconsequential because it was passed against the wishes of majority of Ugandans. Laws are made in the greater interest of society, not a few individuals. This law will remain on the law statutes, but Ugandans will continue to search for the true meaning of democracy for their country.
Museveni, while giving his New Year's address, said the MPs who voted to pass the bill had served Uganda going into a terrible path, attacking groups that opposed this bill.
Alex Gita reporting from Kampala. And Jen, we have some interesting comments.
Yes, you already had one from Morris who said the country was already finished. And we have another one coming in from Prince Yong, who says, he just laughs, by the way, he puts here like, ha, 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 Africa, that's my continent. And he says, let the Ugandans bring him down the same way they lifted him up. This is really nonsense. What's wrong with African leaders?
And William Minta Viafes asks, is history really necessary? I thought it is there to learn from. I guess he implies in 1986 when Museveni was sworn in for the first time. He said, African leaders don't learn from history.
Yeah, like Morris said. And he's repeating the same thing. So that's why William is questioning whether or not we even need history. Enomis Menza says, is he not in bed with Western leaders who are interested in Africa's natural resources? It's a question that he puts there. And Kavuma Brian, also from Uganda, says the only people's hope to remove this selfish president is all gone.
Our usual contributor, Ehosa Godwin, says, may God help them all. Tyranny has come to stay. Okay. Danny Rotimi says, he's learning from Russia. Keep those comments flowing and we'll always read them whenever we can. Now, Iran's supreme leader has accused enemies of the Islamic Republic of stirring unrest across the country as the death toll from anti-government demonstrations that began last week rose to 21. The last major protests took place in 2009 following a presidential election that opposition politicians said was tainted by fraud.
and one of the losing candidates in that election, Hussein Mousavi, still remains under house arrest. Our colleague from DW's First Department, Mehdi Moseni, was a member of the Mousavi campaign back then in 2009. He spoke to DW's Sarah Kelly in Berlin on President Hussein Rouhani's threat to crack down on those behind the protests, and of course, who he is really likely to target.
As I see, the government seems to be holding back for a full crackdown without any leaders. It will be really difficult to target a specific group or people. Rouhani talked about two sides. He talked about the right of people to have a peaceful demonstration. And second thing, it was about the violence that's happened. I can't see really a specific map or a solution for government to, without violence, actually stop this demonstration.
What can you tell us about the main actors in these most recent demonstrations and what their goals might be? I mean, do they want more economic reform or do they want regime change?
Yeah, exactly. This demonstration organized by ordinary people, you cannot see any footprint of official or famous opposition groups. They are mostly young people that they are really angry about economic, about social and political condition in Iran and also economy situation. In my opinion, they want really fundamental change in the system. It's about more about supreme leader, and they really want change. And I think they want regime change in Iran.
DW's Farsi department, Mehdi Moseni, speaking to Sarah Kelly in Berlin. And we continue to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the UN chief Antonio Guterres has warned or called on President Joseph Kabila to abide by an agreement to leave power. At least 8 people died when protests against his rule again erupted last week. Kabila has been in power since 2001.
Now, a year ago, he signed a deal with opposition groups to step down once his current term ends and new elections to be held, but he seems not willing to abide by this. In some parts of DRC, locals often turn to the church for guidance on different matters, including civic duties. And to find out more on why the church wields so much influence in DRC's state affairs, our colleague Christina Kripal has been speaking to Ben Shepherd, a fellow at Chatham House in London. Take a listen.
The church was key to the signing of the accord at the end of 2016. It's pretty much the only institution in the DRC with the moral authority to act as a sort of referee for the political elite and to impose some real pressure on them. They have shown with these demonstrations they're able to get people onto the streets in a way that the formal political opposition haven't been able to. But at the same time, the hierarchy of the church is seen, rightly or wrongly, by many in the DRC as being part of the political system.
This would probably force the leadership of the Catholic Church to take sides too, wouldn't it?
What would happen should control be completely lost? You look back at the events of the early 90s of the two pillages that were started by mutinying soldiers but were carried on by the wider population that did enormous amounts of damage to the city, to their economies, to the lives of people. So they're in a very difficult place, that they want to push for meaningful political change. But they have to be very acutely aware of the fragility of the situation. And yes, were things to spiral out of control, I'm sure they would.
Half of the Congolese population is Catholic, which leaves about 35 million who are not. So how do we explain the power of the Catholic Church in the RDC?
The Catholic churches under the colonial authorities were brought in as service providers, as providers of education, very importantly, and also of healthcare. And as the Congolese state has degraded, the Catholic Church has been left as basically the one national organization with reach and resources that's able to provide anything at all for the population, which is why they are able to play the role they do in its politics.
Christina Kripal speaking to Ben Shepherd from Chatham House in London. Now, one live comment from Wamotala says, Museveni should ask God to also sign onto the bill so that he never dies. That is the story about Uganda, our top story of Museveni signing into law.
And of course, John Tozungwe says it's absolutely not right for him to keep in power. His age and health recently does not allow that. This means he will rule even on a wheelchair.
And Emmanuel says we have to blame the president's advisors.
Keep those comments coming and keep it to Africa Link. You're still tuned to DW's Africa Link program, this first working day of 2018. I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. Remember, Africa Link is live on Facebook at DW Africa. To join the conversation and share the audio. In the next part of the program, we'll be hearing how people living with albinism are discriminated against in Kenya.
You'll find a person with albinism has all the documents that requires to get a job. Person who is in the office will look at the person and feel like can't work with him or her in this office and will be denied the job.
That's not right, especially in the 21st century, Isaac.
Exactly. And we've been reporting about this even in Tanzania, where, you know, body parts, they are being hunted for their body parts. And let's hope, you know, 2018, some hope for the people living with albinism.
Hope is what keeps us going.
Well said, Jen. But first, ushering the new year in style, Mali welcomed a brand new song in the first seconds of the new year. Its message, close link to the coming presidential elections to be held in June 2018. President Ibrahim Bakary Keita, or IBK, who is 72, will probably stand for re-election. 5 years ago, he took office thanks to a huge majority, which he has wasted.
Because he wasted, last year saw a birth of a movement that not only wants to see his back, but a wholesome change of Mali's political system. This brand new tune will play a major role in the change. Bram Posthumous has the story from Bamako.
Scoring own goals, Mali's president Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, called IBK everywhere, is an expert at it. He's been caught up in a wave of corruption scandals, he's failed to change Mali's constitution, and has incited the biggest wave of public discontent in a generation. The mood is angry. It's not just, we want the current leaders out, it's more like, we want a complete change, alternance in French. And that's the issue this song addresses. Here is its creator, Boubacar Sakho, whose artist name is Soldat, Soldier.
I'm a guitar player, singer, songwriter, completely self-taught. I was born in 1985 and, like so many of my generation, I started doing rap and playing reggae. I have come to like the ideas of this new social movement that started last year, so I thought, why not make my contribution to the struggle to improve the life of ordinary Malians?
Soldat wrote his song to call for change and to honor the man who has become the focal point of this new movement, which is, as he says, first and foremost, a youth movement. Mohamed Youssouf Bachili, called Razbaj Everywhere, features heavily in Soldat's message. With mass rallies, a daily radio program where he rails against all the ills from which Mali suffers, Razbaj has become the spokesperson of a generation. Witty, sharp, merciless in his critic as he exposes scandal after corruption scandal, he emerged as the most popular figure in Mali in a poll published late December. And so it was only natural that Soldat would feature him in his song. The title is Waka Bla, a phrase constantly used by Razbaj. It means...
Ce message Bouakabla s'adresse aux dirigeants de ce pays.
Bouakabla announces the changes that are coming in 2018. It concerns our leaders. We're telling them, you're old, you're incompetent, you have not delivered. Go and take a rest and let this generation run the country now, for the good of all Malians.
Le bien-être du peuple malien. La Sissi Mara, Sissi Techno.
Waka Bla was recorded in a very small studio in one of Bamako's sprawling suburbs. The engineer, Amadou Diop, is an old friend of the artist.
I'm very pleased to be part of this production, and I have my friends here to work on this song. You know, I have known Soldat for at least 15 years. We grew up in the same poor neighborhood. We played guitar together, and we continue. This song will have a great effect, I believe.
J'ai confiance.
Waka Bla was released officially on the stroke of midnight that marked the beginning of 2018. The first song of the new year, a marker in the march towards change. Just 2 days before the release, Mali's entire government resigned. President Keita brought in Sumelu Bube Maiga, who had lost his job as defense minister in 2014. Maiga is 63 and deeply ensconced in Mali's ruling elites. In short, this was a change in government that represented no change. Three quarters of Mali's population is under 35, and the country is run by 60 and 70 years old. Time to take a rest indeed, as the song requests.
That was a report by Bram Posthumus. And Jane.
That's an interesting one.
The youth always behind such revolutions asking for regime change. Take an example, the story we just did today, you know, about Iran. It's the youth demanding reform and a regime change. Also in Egypt, it all began in Tahrir Square to kick out
it's
Mubarak.
A whole generational aspect taking on the political scene at the moment, save for the US, of course, and of course Uganda. Mm-hmm. But the youth are not about to accept that, I suppose.
One interesting part of the report, you know, that caught my attention was, you know, most of the ruling, you know, ministers are 60 years and 70 years.
Yes.
These are the leaders are always talking about, you know, the future is in the hands of the youth.
And that's why the youth are saying, hey, excuse me, you've lost touch.
They don't reality. Feature
you
anywhere.
Don't understand the young generation's needs. And so let's keep hoping.
The music tells it all. The change, you know, is coming hopefully in June 2018. And we'll be back right after this.
Africa on the move.
Now, in Tanzania and some other countries in Africa, people with albinism are still being hunted down and killed for their body parts. But just across the border in neighboring Kenya, the situation for people living with the same physical condition is completely different. Despite challenges and some lingering discrimination, they feel much more accepted in society, have jobs, and even run businesses. Eva Dufres visits two brave young businessmen with albinism in Nairobi.
We are in Nairobi's biggest slum, Kibera, where about 1 million people live. In one of the hectic main streets, in between a shoe shop and a kiosk, is a shop called Mzungu Reloaded, where piles of mattresses and bags are for sale. Owner Wycliffe named the shop after himself. Mzungu means white person in Swahili. It's how they refer to tourists and other white-skinned foreigners. But Wycliffe is not a real Mzungu. He has albinism. In Africa, people with albinism stick out more than anywhere else in the world. Besides discrimination, they deal with skin problems due to the hot sun and limited eyesight. Wycliffe therefore wears a hat and glasses. He decided to use his skin color as a trademark in Kibera and named his business after it.
I decided to call that name because most people are calling me according to my nature because I resemble like Mzungu.
Wycliffe is a beneficiary of the Economic Empowerment Program, one of the projects from the Kenya Albinism Society, an advocacy organization spreading awareness about albinism and creating equal opportunities. One of their employees, Daniel Moy, who looks like a fashionable Congolese sapeur with his fancy hat and pink blouse, also has albinism. He explains how important it is for people with albinism to have ordinary jobs and businesses to feel part of society.
Maybe in Tanzania and other neighboring countries, people are being killed. Compared to Kenya, people are not being killed, but they are being discriminated in terms of jobs. You'll find a person with albinism has all the documents that requires to get a job. Person who is in the office will look at the person and feel like this person, we can't work with him or her in this office, and will be denied the job, however much this person has all the documents.
The project is successful at helping to integrate people with albinism into Kenyan society. But even though Kenya can seem like a paradise for people with albinism compared to neighboring Tanzania, some prejudices and beliefs remain, as Daniel explains.
People think persons with albinism don't die, they vanish. That is one thing. Second, they think that when you sleep with a person with albinism, you'll be cured of HIV/AIDS. And then third, they believe that a person with albinism, when you have that body part of a person with albinism, you will be rich and all that. That is what people believe. But that's just a myth. It's not true.
The awareness among Kenyans about people with albinism has grown over the last couple of years. Besides the work of the Albinism Society, the government has been working hard to change things too. People with albinism now get subsidized sunscreen to protect their skin, long-sleeve t-shirts and glasses, for example.
Eva De Vries with that report.
Focus Europe.
Now, Isaac, the next report is basically meant to prepare you and raise your appetite as you prepare
sure,
to head
go
back
ahead,
home.
Go ahead, yeah.
Now, it's official. African food is one of the hottest new food trends in London at the moment. And that's partly thanks to young cooks like Zoe Adijon. Growing up in London with Ghanaian and Irish heritage, she heat up the idea of hosting super clubs to fund her creative writing MA back in 2010. A lot of hard work and a lot of cooking later, she now runs a pop-up restaurant in Brixton and has just published a cookbook entitled Zoe's Ghana Kitchen. Emma Wallace caught up with her at a trendy cafe in East London's Hipster Central.
As a child, being born to two immigrant parents, that made for sort of an interesting diet growing up. You know, on one side it's very Irish, and then my dad's side, he used to bring home these like very exotic ingredients, exotic at the time, you know, fermented maize dough, dumplings like kenke, and smoked fishes like tilapia, and hot pepper sauce like shito.
Zoe Adjonia looks right at home in this hipster cafe just around the corner from her warehouse studio, where she used to host supper clubs back in 2010. But the food she learned to cook from her father took her to another continent entirely.
It's like that connection to home. And once I realised that, because we didn't have much of a Ghanaian family in London, West African food then became a route for me towards understanding that side of my heritage and culture.
Starting with peanut butter stew.
Very famous dish across lots of West Africa, cooked differently in different countries, but it's a very spicy peanut broth dish, which is sweet and savoury at the same time, and people do love it. It's a great comfort food.
Zoe is quick to point out that she is essentially a home cook, not a trained chef, but she's cooked in restaurant residences and festivals across the UK for so long now that her cooking credentials got her a first cookbook deal, which came out this year. Her aim, she said, is to make African food as trendy as tapas in London.
So what I tried to do was create a space through the supper clubs and pop-ups that spoke to Ghanaian heritage and culture and music and the art and the photography and the culture of those places, but was also welcoming and more of a contemporary dining experience for, you know, a UK or a Western market. I made that happen at a time when people weren't really eating or couldn't eat very easily African food, and I guess I was ahead of the curve in some respects on realising that the African food culture was an important thing that people were missing out on, and food coming from those African countries now is filling a real gap.
Zoe's Ghana Kitchen is full, and there's a queue waiting to be seated in the tiny space on the upper level.
I love it. Yeah.
How does it compare then to food back in Ghana?
I think food back home is a lot more rustic. It's just presented in a way that appeals to everyone, and you're actually tempted to give it a go because of just purely based on presentation and the look she's created it very simple, using just a few ingredients.
What made you come here?
I'm a bit nostalgic. I'm on my way to Ghana, so I thought, why not stop over and eat something before you get to Ghana?
Now that she's put Ghanaian food on the map in London, she's about to turn her attention to the rest of the continent and will set off on a trip in 2018, going as far south as Botswana and down the east coastal regions. There might, she thinks, be another cookbook in the works and a new restaurant concept too, proving that business sense, social media and a lot of hard work can turn a home cook into a successful entrepreneur in 21st century London.
Emma Wallace with that interesting report to crown up the day as we head home for dinner.
Many thanks for your contribution. We'll be back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet.